With me now on Fresh Air is Carlos Fuentes, the leading novelist of Mexico whose writing has been hailed around the world. His first and best-known novel, The Death of Artemio Cruz, is about a Mexican revolutionary-turned-profiteer. Like much of his fiction, he uses Mexican history to create a new mythology. To many of his readers, Artemio Cruz has become as much a part of Mexican history as Pancho Villa. His other books include A Change of Skin, Aura, Terra Nostra, The Hydra Head, just published as a new volume of short stories called Burnt Water. His English publisher is Farrar Straus Giroux. Although his literature draws heavily on Mexican history, much of his life has been spent outside the country. He was born in Panama, where his father was then serving on a diplomatic post at the Mexican legation. His father was chief of protocol of the Mexican Foreign Ministry from 1945 to 1952, and Carlos Fuentes was brought up in schools in Washington, D.C., Chile, Buenos Aires, and Mexico City. Before fully devoting himself to writing, he served the Mexican government as a delegate to the UN, a member of the Foreign Service, and director of the Department of Cultural Relations. He's since taught in universities around the world. He's an adjunct professor of English for the fall semesters at the University of Pennsylvania, and during these fall semesters, he lives in Princeton. He still considers his home base to be Mexico. In his official biography, Fuentes is described as being politically left of center, a Mexican nationalist who has been critical of both American and Soviet intervention in Cuba, Hungary, Santo Domingo, and Czechoslovakia. Carlos Fuentes, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank
it's
you,
a great honor to meet you and to
it's
have you here.
It's a great honor to be with you.
I'd like to ask you, if I may, to have you read your author's note to your new volume of short stories, which is called Burnt Water.
Burnt Water, yes. I'd be delighted, Terry. This is the text. It says, I own an imaginary apartment house in the center of Mexico City. The penthouse is occupied by an old revolutionary-turned-profiteer, Artemio Cruz. In the basement lives a ghostly sorceress, Aura. On the 11 intermediary floors, you will find the characters of the stories that are now collected here. True, some have fled to the countryside, others are living abroad, some have even been evicted and now wander in the internal exile of the belt of misery surrounding this great cancer stain of a smog-ridden, traffic-snarled metropolis of 17 million people. By the end of the century, it will fatally be the largest city in the world, the capital of underdevelopment. My imaginary building is sinking into the uneasy mud where the humid god, the Chacmol, lives. There, a birth is recalled, that of the oldest city in the Americas, Tenochtitlan, founded in 1325 by the wandering Aztecs on a high lagoon guarded by sparkling volcanoes and conquered in 1521 by the Spanish, who there erected the viceregal city of Mexico on the burnt water of the ancient Indian lake. Burnt water, Atl Tlaxinoli. The paradox of the creation is also the paradox of the destruction. The Mexican character never separates life from death, and this too is the sign of the burnt water that has presided over the city's destiny in birth and rebirth.
In that author's note, you refer to some of the characters from different novels as well as some of the images and characters to be discovered in your new volume of short stories.
Indeed, yes. I refer to Artemio Cruz and to Aura. Artemio Cruz belongs to the novel called The Death of Artemio Cruz and represents more or less the realistic and social dimension of my writing. Aura is the character of a ghost story by the same name and represents another dimension, the dimension of the fantastic, let's say.
Well, in this author's note, you gather them together in this mythological place that you've created. What connections do you see between the novels and the characters you've created in your short stories? It really seems to me like they are all part of one big, large mythology that you've created in your mind.
Well, yes. You know, I think the writer who formed me the most, the novelist who influenced me the most when I was in my teens, was Balzac. Actually, I remember taking a boat to Europe when I was about 19 years old with the Human Comedy of Balzac and a dictionary in order to learn French. So I learned French by reading Balzac, but I learned many other things as well. And was the possibility of having your personal vision, your interior vision, coincide, yes, but also transcend, comment upon, distort the social and political scene of your age. I think that novels are always born of history, but that they, in some way they must transcend history, that they must show us the way out of history so as not to be the prisoners, or rather the slaves of history, so as to have a vision of history. Also that you cannot avoid the political in the sense that all novels are born from and take place in the polis, in the city, in a civilization, in a relation with others, but that the political element of a novel must always be in tension with something one could call, giving it the title of one of Balzac's novels, the search for the absolute, that metaphysical hunger, which is also present in most great novels. And this tension between the life of the city, the political in the purest sense, and the metaphysical, the search for the absolute, is what gives its great tension to the novels by Balzac, to Dostoevsky, think of the demons, the possessed, for example. Think of many of the novels by Flaubert, etc. And these are lessons I have kept very much alive and present in my mind when I write, yeah.
One of the focal points in the history that you draw upon is the Mexican Revolution,
yes.
Obviously in the death of Artemio Cruz,
yeah.
But also in some of your short stories, there's a grandfather who was a revolutionary, mm-hmm. or a young person who knows some of the mythology of the revolution and wishes to be in it, or someone whose wealth and possessions have been affected by the revolution.
Yes.
What part did that have in your own family history?
Well, the revolution affected everyone in Mexico. It was really a revolution. It was not a coup d'etat. It was not a palace intrigue, a pronunciamiento, a military takeover, anything of the sort. It was a real thoroughgoing revolution. I've been very critical of some of the results of the revolution. I think that in many aspects it has not lived up to its promise. But I also see that it did something essential in the life of Mexico, and it is that it broke up the traditional isolation of the Mexican people. You know, when Cortés returned to Spain after conquering the Aztec Empire, what had become the colony of New Spain, the Emperor Charles V asked him to describe this land he had just conquered for him, a land six or seven times the size of Spain. And Cortés saw a stiff parchment on the table of the Emperor, picked it up, crumpled it, and threw it back, and said, "There is Mexico. This is Mexico." You know, a land of extreme isolation, of abrupt jagged mountains, deep chasms, deserts, incommunication. And this is something that the Mexican Revolution, to a great degree, broke. This is, I think, finally the cultural sense of the revolution. Apart from its political, economic programs, as a cultural fact, it communicated the Mexican people amongst themselves. It broke down these barriers. When you see these great cavalcades, you know, of the peasant leaders of the revolution, Pancho Villa coming from Chihuahua and Coahuila, from the north, from the Texas border, to Mexico City, Zapata coming from the south towards Mexico City, Alvaro Obregón and his battalions of Yaqui Indians coming from the North Pacific coast from Sonora and Sinaloa. Well, in their wake, they brought all the villages of Mexico with them in a way, and for the first time, Mexicans were capable of meeting other Mexicans, of knowing how other Mexicans laughed and cried and sang and thought and made love and hated and killed. This was an enormous event in the life of the country. It uprooted us all. There was a corrido, you know, a ballad, a song of the Mexican Revolution that said, "Vino el remolino y nos levantó." The whirlwind came and uprooted us all. It affected the life of everyone in the country. My grandfather, who was a prosperous banker in Veracruz, he suffered greatly from the revolution. He lost his position. He had been a part of the administrative cadres of the Porfirio Díaz regime. My father had to work and study, become a lawyer, and go up from zero again. The whole country was topsy-turvied. My father, who in a way his family had suffered the consequences of the revolution, became an advocate for the revolution as a Mexican diplomat, an explainer, a defensor of the revolution, especially in the very difficult years when he was counselor of the Mexican embassy in Washington in the 30s, when relations between the two countries were extremely tense, extremely difficult. And imagine, a few years ago, you ask of the way the revolution affected my life and my vision of my country. A few years ago, I was traveling around the central Mexican state of Jalisco with the president of Mexico at the time, Luis Echeverria. And a stop had been planned at one of the villages of the Huichol Indians, the Huichol people in the mountains of Jalisco. A special landing strip had been constructed for the presidential plane. It was a difficult landing because these villages are on high mountaintops, on table mesas, and surrounded by gorges, by canyons as deep as the Colorado River Canyon, in this case, the Canyon of the Santiago River. We arrived there, we landed, and the chiefs of the tribe and the people of the tribe came up to say hello to us, dressed in their wonderful costumes, great colors. And the president asked him, "What do you want? What can I give you?" And he said, "Look, can you look over the ravine, over this deep canyon, to the other side?" "Yes." "Do you see the people on the other side?" "Yes." "Do you see them waving at us?" "Yes." "Well, you know, ever since we can remember, we have waved at each other. We've never been able to touch each other, to touch our hands. Could you lend us your great silver bird to take us over the canyon and finally touch the hands of our brothers who are on the other side?" So the president was very moved, so were we all. And finally the two peoples met and embraced and touched and drank and ate together. So I said, "God Almighty, this is Mexico, really. This is Mexico. This incredibly complex and varied country where people can live for 2,000 years looking at each other generation after generation over a canyon without touching."
I guess that's, in a way, what you're trying to do as a novelist, is to create the stories in which you can point to those stories and say, this is Mexico. This story just embodies so much of Mexican history. No, there's the history that you learn from the stories that are passed on in your family and the stories that are passed on in your community, and then the history that you learn when you go off to college to study. Mm-hmm. How have you learned your history that you draw upon for your novels?
Well, you're absolutely right, Terry, in what you say. All tribes have stories that keep them together. The stories become the myths of the tribe. And Jung says that the myth is not an expression of the spiritual life of the tribe. No, it is the spiritual life of the tribe. And if you take the myth away, if you lose the myth, you fall to pieces. You crumble. Your soul is lost. This is the essence of storytelling, what Jung says. This is the essence. The tribe, the community, the society, the nation is kept alive by the stories that are told and passed from one generation to another. This is the great power of language and of imagination. In some societies, it is greater than in others, naturally.
Who are your readers in Mexico?
My readers in Mexico are the middle class, the students. The fact that has helped novelists enormously in Mexico is the fact that there are more and more people coming into the education process, more and more people who learn to read and write, more and more young people who, when they're 15 or 16, say, "Well, what book should I read in order to find out about my country?" And they go to poets such as Octavio Paz or López Velarde, and they go to novelists such as Mariano Azuela or Martín Luis Guzmán or Juan Rulfo or Agustín Yáñez or José Revueltas or myself. So our books are always in print, because there's always a new wave, a new generation of people coming into the vast reading public of Mexico, which is growing all the time, in a country where half of the population is 25 years old or less.
Although you have become a creator of Mexican mythology, you have spent a lot of your time living outside of Mexico. Yeah. Even a lot of your childhood was spent outside of it.
Yes.
Where do you place yourself in relation to Mexico? Do you see yourself as someone who's part of it but is largely outside of it? Or do you feel inside?
You know, a lot of books in this world have been written by people outside their countries of origin. Hemingway, for example. And Fitzgerald is examples, recent examples here in the United States. I think that whatever I was able to give to Mexican literature in my very first novel, Death, Where the Air is Clear, and then the Death of Artemio Cruz, was due to the fact that I had lived outside Mexico, that I spent my childhood outside Mexico, that I had to create my vision of Mexico without living in Mexico. because I was a Mexican, because my father told me I was a Mexican, because he introduced me to the history and the literature of Mexico, but from outside, and that I had to compare this vision I had of my own country when I came back to it with the reality I was presented with. And the shock, the tension between what I had imagined to be Mexico and what was actually Mexico was a profound detonator for whatever I had to say. And what I had to say was essentially different, new to what writers were then saying or what people of my own generation were seeing because they had been brought up in Mexico. No, for me, Mexico was a novelty. It was sometimes a corroboration of what I had thought. Sometimes it was a negation. Sometimes it was a dream. Sometimes it was a nightmare. So I was able to inject a lot of myself and my life and my fears and my criticism into this vision of the country, which probably no other writer of my generation could have had because none of them grew up outside Mexico.
What shocked you the most when you went to Mexico?
The lack of innocence. The lack of innocence, the total lack of innocence. It is one of the most malicious countries in the world. And I had come from more innocent countries, especially your country.
You were in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, and I had gone to school in Washington, D.C., and I must say that American kids are quite naive, quite innocent, and well-intentioned. Then I was in countries of the southern cone of the Americas, Chile and Argentina, in English schools, where also certain values and forms were very much accepted and almost taken for granted. I arrived in Mexico at an incredibly violent country with an incredible capacity for the malicious, for the double entendre, for cynicism, for many things which came to me as a shock in young people. I had not seen them in young people either in Chile or in the United States.
So did you feel alienated when you moved
there? I was made to feel very alienated. I wasn't dressed like a Mexican. I was dressed like an Argentinian schoolboy with golf pants. Nobody used golf pants in Mexico. My golf pants were made fun of. I had to go to school with a tie because in the British schools you had to wear the old school tie throughout the year. It was considered bad form not to do it. I was laughed off the places because I played cricket, imagine. I was an alien. I played baseball and I had a small accent and also I had another sense of the world, a very different sense of the world. I remember when I arrived in Mexico, it was the final year of the war. It was 1945. And Mexicans, by and large, were profoundly Germanophile. They were all in favor of the Nazis for the simple fact that whoever is against the Americans must be good. This was the rationale. And so there was this great to-do about the Nazis must win the war. What we admire in them is their technique, their know-how, their efficiency, all the things Mexico was not, of course. And I told them, God, do you know anything about concentration camps? Do you know that if the Nazis arrived in Mexico, all of you would become soap or lampshade because you are not Caucasians, you are not Aryans? Well, I was scoffed and laughed. The concentration camps were supposed to be an invention of Allied propaganda at the time, you see. So I had all these frictions. At the same time, I knew I was profoundly Mexican, and I was sort of throwing an X-ray vision at the country. And I was seeing that I landed in the middle of my class, which is the Mexican middle class, the Mexican bourgeoisie, that they had no conscience whatsoever of the Indian world of Mexico. And I did, because I had studied it, and I had imagined Mexico as an Indian country. I had imagined Mexico as a colonial country. I had imagined Mexico as a country with a soul divided. I had imagined Mexico as many, many things which the people of my class did not. They thought themselves as modern, westernized people and did not realize that the country was so much more. And this I tried to bring into my novels.
Although the leaders of revolutions are frequently educated people who come from the middle or upper classes, it is, on the other hand, very difficult sometimes for people who are from educated middle or upper class families to justify what they have and what they've been given in the light of the poverty they see around them. Was that ever a difficult thing for you to reconcile?
No, it was not. It was not because I have never believed in a socialism that will sink everybody into poverty. I am a Marxist in that sense, that I think socialism is a development from wealth, not from poverty. that you do not go from poverty to socialism, from misery to socialism. This is the misery of socialism. And the great bane of socialism in the 20th century is that it has occurred in underdeveloped countries, in countries with rickety economic and social structures, such as Russia, or other countries of the third world that have no business calling themselves socialists. They can call themselves developing countries embarked upon an accelerated accumulation of capital through an accumulation of work, of labor. But this is not socialism. Socialism has to come from development. Since I always thought this, that socialism had to be a development from wealth and not from poverty, and that it had to bring with it the conscience of all that had been conquered by the past history of advanced societies, including freedom of speech, intellectual freedoms, political freedoms. I was never in conflict in that sense. I've always been in conflict in the sense that as a Mexican, I said, yes, I am well off, and the majority of my people are not, but what am I supposed to do? Become a right-wing fascist in order to have a good conscience? No.
Many people feel almost romantic about their roots and their heritage, that their heritage is beautiful and something to be celebrated and to discuss and to take pride in. And I've always felt that perhaps that's a gift that alienated people never have, because if you go home and you feel a little uncomfortable and alienated there, you can't really participate in that celebration of your roots, can you?
No, I think you must have a conflictive view of your origins and your past. I think that if you only celebrate, you're going towards a trouble zone. The United States, for example, is a country that has celebrated itself, its roots, its origins, much too much, with sometimes without a sufficient critical view. What happened to Indians? What happened to blacks in this country? What happened to the poor in this country? There are still great, great pockets of misery. There's a very uneven distribution of wealth in the United States. Given the fact of the massive wealth it has, there are very, very few have everythings, and a lot of have little or have less or have nothing. I think the problem is really a problem of how you regard your own past, what conscience you have of your past. In Mexico, I think we have a conflictive vision of our own past. Our past is not solved yet. If you were able to take a TV camera and put it in the minds of 90% of Mexicans, and you tuned in at 6:30 to catch the Mexican evening news, as it passed through the minds of most Mexicans, you would have first item in the news, the conquest of Mexico. Moctezuma and Cortes fighting it out still today in 1980 in the minds of the people. Which is something that doesn't happen here. I mean, Pocahontas and John Smith are not the principal item in the minds of the historical minds of most people in the United States, is it? So we have this unresolved conflict. How do we redeem the past? Whereas the United States has been a country always directed towards the future. It addresses the future. The United States is nothing if it is not a country with a future, made for the future. Now, when suddenly you arrive in 1980 in the United States, you feel that more and more people believe the country doesn't have a future. And this is a grave crisis for the United States. And I think that what the third world, and especially your neighboring country, Mexico, can give you is the sense, the conviction that in order to have a future, the future must have a past. That you must recapture the conscience of your past and of the fact that the past is not an object of celebration, of applause, but of conflict and of criticism.
Well, you spend a lot of time in America, and I'm sure have seen a lot of ethnic groups, groups of different countries, different religions and races, trying to get in contact again with their original culture.
Yes.
And celebrating that. Do you feel that one must really reckon with the
Yes, but these roots are not folkloric. They take place within a larger social and economic spectrum, that of the whole society of the United States, of its politics. They can be disassociated and become May Day parades, you know, carnivals, Halloweens. They can be separated. The melting pot takes place within a given economic and social structure. This is something one has to understand. Besides, what is different now is that you can celebrate the roots when you're very far from them. when they are distant in time and distant in space. But what happens to the melting pot? What happens to the celebration of roots when they come from nearby sources of culture, from over land, not from overseas, when they come from across the border, as is the case of Mexico, or from cultures that are very nearby, as is the case of Puerto Rico and Cuba and other Latin American Hispanic countries. Then the melting pot doesn't know exactly what to do with these people. Then it doesn't know what to do about this celebration of the roots you're talking about. Should education be bilingual or not? Should they become Americans, full-fledged Americans, with the English language as their primary tool of work? Or should they start creating a bilingual and even a bicultural society in the United States? This poses a tremendous challenge to the melting pot and to the whole problem of celebration of roots that you've brought up, yes?
Well, I'm sure you have strong views on things like bilingual cities, bilingual schools. Mm. And also I'd be really interested in hearing briefly what type of immigration policy you'd like to see America have, particularly towards Mexico, since a lot of people have been going illegally yeah. across the border and been finding it very difficult
to
get food and work.
Well, this is a vast problem, as you know. I don't think we could exhaust it in 1 hour or two. But to be very simplistic about it, let us say there is a Mexican problem involved here, and it is a problem of our society, our economy, having to offer employment. It doesn't offer enough employment because it's not sufficiently developed, sufficiently organized. It doesn't offer enough employment to millions of Mexicans. 20% of the labor force is unemployed, as a matter of fact, in Mexico. There are great pockets of misery. So first of all, it's our problem. It is a Mexican problem. This has to be said, and I admit it. And it is our problem to pinpoint the pockets of misery in Mexico. Know the states. There are six or seven states where 80 or 90% of the undocumented workers travel to the United States. There's also a Mexican problem in the sense that Mexico cannot avoid by totalitarian means that our people emigrate, that they move freely around. It would be a radical violation of the Charter of the United Nations and of all the statutes of the International Labor Organization as well. Then there is the American problem, let's say, which is the fact that these workers work in the United States, and therefore the United States has the right, undoubtedly, the sovereign right to decide under what conditions they come in and work in the country. But then let us say there is the international problem, or the common problem Mexico and the United States share, and then they share with the worldwide community, because immigration from the developing South to the developed North is a worldwide phenomenon. It is not only on the Mexican-American border that this happens. And there are many, many problems are posed. Many problems are posed. In the first place, the essential problem, which is that undocumented workers coming from Mexico are that. They are workers. They are not criminals. Whatever else you might think about them, they are looking for work. They are not killers. They are not stealers. They are not criminals. Therefore, they cannot be treated as criminals. They cannot be shot. They cannot be chained, as they sometimes are, humiliated, thrown into jail, treated as animals. This cannot happen. It's a violation of your constitution. It is a violation of the Charter of Human Rights. It is a violation of the policy of human rights the United States has fortunately defended internationally. Then there is the whole problem of who should defend the workers. How should the problem be regulated? I think that finally, in the long range, the problem can only be solved by self-defense. I happen to think this, that the workers must defend themselves, that it is very difficult for the Mexican government to protect them, for the American government to protect them, that they have to protect themselves, and that eventually a union must be created of migrant workers, an international union of migrant workers. Because these are problems which, I say, affect Turkish workers, Spanish, Portuguese, Italian workers going from the south towards the north. We know that these workers do jobs that are needed in the American society, and if they don't do them, nobody will do them. Mexican workers are transitory workers. Out of eight workers that come into the United States, seven go back to Mexico, yet 80% of them pay Social Security. 78% of them pay federal income tax. They come and work in your country, but you have not invested in their education. Mexico has subsidized the American economy in a way. All these factors have to be taken into account before tortilla walls are erected on the border between, before the Rodino law strikes employers of the migrant workers, before repressive legislation or action is enacted in this country. All these factors, I think, have to be considered.
Well, I'm glad you haven't tried to simplify a very complex situation.
No, as I say, we could go on for a long time, but
yeah,
for the purpose of our interview,
right,
these are some of the things I would like to say. Yeah.
Let me reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. My guest is the internationally acclaimed novelist Carlos Fuentes, and just a reminder, he has a new volume of short stories that has just been published, and this volume is called Burnt Water. It seems that that many Mexicans' first-hand knowledge of Americans is through the tourist industry, since a lot of Americans go for nice warm vacations in Mexico. And, of course, many stay at very expensive hotels, and it must make for a lot of animosity, since you see a lot of Americans traveling first class in real style, and there's so much poverty in the cities that the Americans stay in. Is there a sense of resentment that many Mexicans feel?
No, I wouldn't say that. Because, first of all, Terry, the American tourist is very isolated from the real population of Mexico. They come into contact with waiters and busboys and chauffeurs and the people who serve them on the tourist circuit. And the tourist circuit is in itself quite isolated from the real Mexico. So, I think there isn't animosity, hate America attitudes in Mexico. That isn't true. There are objective problems between the two countries and a conscience of defense. Mexico has suffered at the hands of the United States in the past. The Mexican War, invasions, 1914, 1917, menaces, pressures throughout our history. This has not created hate. On the contrary, I would say that there is a great love for the United States in Mexico, a desire to understand and be understood, an acceptance of the fact that we are neighbors, an admiration for many things American, on the condition that as we admire and respect many of your values, you should admire and respect ours and consider the differences and respect the differences between the two countries. But basically, the problems between the two countries are problems to be solved in an objective fashion, not with guts, not with bile, not with passion, but really considering the objectivity of the problems. This is what Mexican foreign policy is all about. It's what we have been asking of the United States. When President Carter visited Mexico in February of 1979, what President López Portillo was asking him was that they both understand the nature of relations between the two countries, rather that they define the nature of these relations in the broader sense, in the philosophical, historical, cultural sense. This was a call to understanding. It was difficult, perhaps, for pragmatic Americans to understand. And President Carter committed a terrible faux pas, he answered, with his joke about Moctezuma's revenge and whatnot. And the opportunity was lost. The opportunity was lost, yet because Mexico and the United States are neighbors. And the United States only has two neighbors in the world. The United States only has Mexico and Canada as neighbors to talk to see the world as it is, to shed some of its illusions, to understand the other. It has Mexico and it has Canada. But the relation with Mexico is even more specific than the relation with Canada, because the border between Mexico and the United States is not only the border between Mexico and the United States. It is the border between the most powerful military and economic power in the world and a developing country, a weak, medium-sized nation. It is the frontier between the industrialized and the developing world. It is the frontier between the United States and the whole of Latin America. It is the frontier in the New World between the victorious Anglo-Saxon Protestant strain of the North and the sometimes defeated, more versatile because of that, Latin Catholic South. It is many things, many cultural, economic, political things. So the relations between the two countries offer an extraordinary opportunity for the United States to understand the world. And I think people everywhere, both in Europe and in The Third World will be looking in the coming years to see what relations between Mexico and the United States are like in order to have a sense of what American policy towards the Third World will be like in the coming years, in the long run.
It's amazing that you have so much experience both as a diplomat and as someone who very deeply understands Mexico's history and politics and the relationship between Mexico and America and Mexico and other countries. But at the same time, you're a storyteller and you know all the folk stories and know so much just about the color and the texture and the street life in the city. It seems that you'd have to call on very different voices within you to be able to tell both those stories and to operate on that analytical level and on the more textural level. I'd like to talk about literature a little bit. We've been talking.
You're telling me about the about making a virtue of necessity, huh? This is true also of this is true throughout Latin America and throughout Eastern Europe. It's also very typical of the Eastern European, a Polish, Hungarian, Czech writer must be like this also. We must do many, many things because if we don't do them, nobody else will.
We know a lot of the Czech writers who are receiving international recognition now are emigres. They've left their country because they've had to in order to write.
They're not even published.
Right. Again, you've left your country for different reasons. You haven't really left it even.
Mexico is not Czechoslovakia, fortunately.
Right, right. Let's talk a little bit about literature. Many people seem to be in agreement that the Latin American novel is just one of the places that people are looking for new vitality within the novel. And the three authors that are most widely referred to are yourself, Borges, and Marquez. What are some of the reasons, do you think, why there is so much activity in the novel happening amongst Latin American authors? Since the question in this country, not so much now, but a few years ago, was, gee, is the novel dead or dying?
Yeah. Well, precisely, it's good that you mentioned this, because I was, many years ago, it was 1971 or two, I guess, I was talking with one of your best authors, Donald Botham, and he was saying, how do you manage to write all these novels in Latin America, these fat, thick novels, going for 800, 1,000 pages sometimes? Oh, my God. We in the United States, we feel, writers feel there's not that many things to write about. There's very little to write about. Well, I answered him, in our part of the world, we feel we have everything to write about. This isn't true anymore. I mean, in a year that has produced Sophie's Choice and The Executioner's Song, one can't talk about American writers not having anything to say or writing thin volumes. That is not the case. The literature in this country is very much alive. What I mean to say is that for us it is being a particular challenge to find that there are so many things that have not been said in the present and in the past as well, and that if you do not say them through literature, they will never be said. They will be dead matter. We'll suffer from amnesia. And what you see, this great flowering of Latin American narrative and poetry, means that we are going back to our very origins. We're trying to reconstruct our tradition, our past, because what Latin America has had is a continuous cultural tradition, almost uninterrupted from Indian times to the present, and a broken political tradition. We have a deep river of culture running throughout our veins, our body, and we have an archipelago of lost illusions on the political sea. The only possibility for the political archipelago to become at least a peninsula, to unite in some way, is to work on this common heritage we have, which is the language. And the language is the memory, and the memory is the history, and the history is the past and the present and the future. So working with language, working with imagination, we are able of constructing our only viable polity, you see. It's the only living thing we have, and it's the only way we can say these things, which, given the nature of our societies, repressive nature in most cases, are not said by unions, by Congress, by media, by no one. It is the novelist, it is the poet who has the voice of history. And I repeat, not only of the history of the present, but of this great interregnum of the silence of the Spanish language, when the Inquisition and the Counter-Reformation really take hold of Spain, the middle of the 17th century, until the war with the United States in 1898, Spanish literature is a desert. Is a desert. So we have to fill this great void in our own tradition, in our own language, you see. We have to go back to Cervantes, back to Quevedo, back to Góngora, back to the great writers of the Golden Age of Spain in order to tie the knot of the language and recuperate the tradition. Well, these are challenges that a writer in the English language doesn't have. Because you've had an uninterrupted tradition since ever. I mean,
I think one of the challenges of a writer like Donald Barthelme, who you just referred to, is to try to understand and to expand the notion of the novel or the short story, and to play with language itself, and to make that experiment with language and with form become almost the subject of the story or the novel.
Yeah.
How do you feel like you're working with the form of the novel or the short story?
I feel formally, the novel is one of the great inventions of Western literature and of the Western civilization, and that it is a form that comes into being with the dawn of the critical age, the Renaissance, with Cervantes, with Don Quixote, because the modern age feels it must wield the arm of criticism. It must criticize the world. It must criticize the past. It must criticize privilege, feudalism, absolutism, etc. This is the sense of the modern age. And the novel plays the fundamental role of giving body to the imagination of criticism of the West, to proposing man as a problem, proposing man as a constant question mark. Like Don Quixote, when Picasso draws him in black ink, he looks like a question mark. This is precisely what the novel is doing, constantly asking questions, constantly re-proposing the problems of men and women. Therefore, the novel, by offering this constant criticism of the world, by saying everything must be under the harsh light of criticism always, lest we fall asleep and fall back into autocracy, into feudalism, into repression, also implies that it must criticize itself constantly, its own form. The novel criticizes the world because it is capable of criticizing itself. And the first novel that does this is Don Quixote de la Mancha. Don Quixote is the first novel in which the character, the principal character, knows he is being written about. Something that Achilles never knew when he approached the walls of Troy, that there were books being written about him. And even false books, which is something Don Quixote finds out, I'm being written about. Our adventures are being published, Sancho Panza tells him. There's even an apocryphal work by a man called Avellaneda going the rounds, and Don Quixote changes route within his novel and goes to Barcelona to denounce this man Avellaneda. Well, this has never happened before, you see. And this is all to do with the critical form of the novel.
There's a number of historical novels that have been at the top of American bestseller lists, and I'd include in that something like Shogun, which is a Japanese historical novel, some of the novels by James Michener, which usually reach the bestseller list. Do you feel there's any connection between the kind of historical novel that you're writing and the kind of historical novel that reaches the bestseller list in America?
No. These novels you're talking about, Michener and Shogun and Centennial and Chesapeake and Colorado and whatnot, they are didactic novels. The writer informs himself, he studies weighty tomes and volumes, and then writes instructive novels, and the public reads them with great pleasure because they feel they're getting their money's worth. Oh boy, I'm getting an education reading this, so it's worth the $15 I invested. This has nothing to do with imagination. I'm talking about the critical imagination of history as you find it in 100 Years of Solitude. Compare 100 Years of Solitude with Shogun and you'll know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, so what do you say to a novelist who has a moral or a lesson that he wants to pass on to his readers and justifies the novel through that lesson?
But especially a novel has to have imagination, my God. The knowledge the novel imparts is the knowledge of literature, which is imagination. Politics, science, philosophy, logic give you another type of knowledge, which is logical, causal knowledge. Literature gives you a knowledge which is particular to it and which is called imagination, and you can't live without it.
Carlos Fuentes is my guest, and we're talking about his writing. How close are you with the other writers who I referred to recently, Marquez and Borges? Do you communicate
much? Well, no, García Márquez is a very old friend of mine. We've done many things together. We've even written films together. We've had a very close relationship over the past 20 years. Borges is a man who's 81 years old, and I've never met him, and I don't want to meet him.
Why not?
I want to admire his writing. I admire his writing enormously, but I don't like his politics, and I don't like flirtatious blind old men.
That's something that I think every interviewer has to ask themselves, like how will meeting a person and finding out what kind of personality they have affect the way they feel about a person's art, whether it's, you know, music or literature or whatever.
Yes.
Is that something that you've had to face, or can you separate someone's personality and whether they tell good stories and have a nice sense of humor and are fun to go to dinner with their abilities as an artist?
Well, no, you must separate them, because can you imagine going to dinner with Dostoevsky? What a horrible thing, huh? To have Kafka as a neighbor must have been a very depressive thing. Sometimes it's good to read them only and have nothing to do with them personally. At times, the person and his writing coincide. Sometimes the persons are wonderful and the writing is very bad, but then hooray for the person. You like to go out to dinner with him, even if his writing is bad.
Your work in America is published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux, and I believe your work has been translated mostly by different... You've had a number of translators.
Yes, until I found my present translator, who's an excellent translator, Margaret Sayers Peden, and we've worked very well for my past three books.
What do you look for in a translator?
Oh, where you find is someone who knows the English language in the first place. I mean, the translator has to know the language from which he translates, but he has to know his own language even better. He might know Spanish very, very well, but then know English badly, and then so much for the translation. Then, of course, a translator has to create a new book in the language into which he translates. There's no such thing as an absolutely loyal translation. Fidelity sometimes ruins the purpose of the translation. The reader in English would not understand a totally faithful translation. It would be the worst kind of betrayal. So this is more evident in poetry than in the novel. When Robert Lowell translates Baudelaire or Góngora, it is a new poem by Robert Lowell. And this is as it should be. It becomes a new event in the English language. The original poems are events in the French and Spanish language, and they cannot be transposed into anything else. The same to a great degree is true of novels, especially as novels take more and more root in poetry. As novels are, dispossessed of many of the traditional elements, plot, characterization, logical, causal storyline, etc., they are left with nothing but the bare facts of language, that is, of the poetry and the poetical vision and poetical imagination inherent in all good writing. So they become more like poems, and this poses that sort of problem for the translation. How to make of the book, whatever it was in the original language, an event in the English language.
You wouldn't consider translating your works to English?
No. Why should I? I would lose 2 years of my creative work. I would stop writing novels in order to translate myself. I don't love myself that much.
So how closely will you work with someone who's translating it?
Oh, quite. If I know the language, well, but I don't know all the languages in the world. My books are translated into 22 languages, and I can only work with my French, my Italian, and my English language translators. The rest, I just abide by what they say. I let the brick falls on my head.
Mm-hmm. Right, but so for English, you'll make suggestions if you don't like the way
Yes, oh, no, yes.
Can you give us an example of something that you were unhappy with and that you changed?
No, I wouldn't say anything, because with my present translation, I've never had any trouble. I've had some troubles in the past, but they've all been solved. And I think I've had a good relationship with my translators.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The new volume of your short stories, Burnt Water, it's short stories. Why have you left the novel temporarily for short stories?
No, you see, these have been
written
almost
for years,
an anthology
right.
of my short stories. Some of them appeared as early as 1964. And, my publishers and I also thought it was a good moment to bring out some of these stories in a volume. They're not all my stories. It's just a selection of the stories which I thought would be interesting to group around the Mexico City theme. All these stories are related to life in Mexico City. They have this common theme. And... I think Mexico City is a fact of the imagination, which is very present in my life, in my work, and the stories are.
One of the themes that crops up in a lot of your stories and novels is a distrust of piety and religion. If you don't mind my asking, are you or have you ever been a religious man?
Well, I am a religious man in a way. I find this out. that whether I like it or not, I belong to the culture of Catholicism. And I realize this very much when I come to the United States, which has such a clear Protestant ethic. Even Catholics in the United States are Protestants in a way, because they believe in the ethics of Protestantism, of direct access to the grace of God, of good works, of predestination in a way, many of the capitalism, etc. I have fought many of the more unjust aspects of the church in Mexico. The church has had, as you know, a political role in Mexico, and it is being a repressive and oppressive role most of the time. But now something is happening. Something extraordinary is happening throughout the world, Terry. I think it is the prime event of international life. People don't want to see it because they are very accustomed to dealing with nation states, with ideologies, with many conventions of the 19th century. Suddenly what we have is a reappearance on the world stage of the cultures as protagonists. Whole cultures appear with their baggage, their artistic baggage, their cultural baggage, their religious baggage. Look at Iran. Look at the whole Islamic world. Look at Latin America in the future. Undoubtedly, Catholicism will play a role. Undoubtedly, what we see in Poland today is a revolution in which the culture plays a paramount role, and that is why it's so difficult for the Soviet Union to respond to it, because it's not only the ideology, it is the whole culture acting up, and one of the great strengths of the culture is the Catholic religion. The nationality and the religion go together in Poland. Concessions have to be made. You have to have a deputy prime minister who is a Catholic. Lech Walesa appears with the Pope's photograph everywhere. The religion is there as part of the culture, as part of this new protagonistic element of history, which is the cultures, great, great cultures appearing as protagonists on the stage. And state departments, foreign chancelleries, do not know what to make of this. How do you deal really with the Ayatollah Khomeini and all he represents? Huh? Camus said in 1950 something that becomes of relevance today in The Rebel. He wrote, we now see that man cannot only revolt to get out of religion, but also revolt to get into religion. A revolt into religion. Are we seeing this? You know, the great revolution of the Enlightenment of the 18th century was to say, before Nietzsche ever said it, God is dead. We are the masters of our history. History was made by men, not by gods, and therefore we are responsible for our history. But after the disasters of the 20th century, after the concentration camps and the Gulag and the Holocaust and the atomic bomb and all the horrors and sufferings that in the name of man have been perpetrated in the 20th century, we are now asking ourselves, is this the world we are responsible for? And we can no longer accuse God of making this world. Now we must accuse ourselves. So there's a reappearance of God as the co-culprit with man. And sometimes he seems to be less guilty than we are for the mess we've created. So there is a return of the religious spirit. And this is not in the sense of political oppression of the things I've criticized, but in the deeply humanistic and the profoundly creative sense that men such as Graham Greene or François Mauriac or Bernanos or Teilhard de Chardin or Jacques Maritain, or Simone Weil, above all, this great woman, this great Jewish and Christian woman who was Simone Weil, understood the problem of religion, the revolt into the sacred, into the sacred.
Wow, interesting response. We're about out of time. I'm wondering, you know, you spend...
It has flown.
It has flown. You spend your falls in this area, teaching at the University of Pennsylvania and living in Princeton.
Oh, it's a great experience, yes. I have a splendid group of students here in Philadelphia. I enjoy them very, very much, and they're very creative people, very quick and intelligent and creative. So I have always a yearning to come back to my falls in Philadelphia. Are very, very productive. I teach, but I'm also taught a great deal.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Tim.
You were able to come and speak with us.
Thank you so much.
I've been speaking with Carlos Fuentes, an internationally acclaimed novelist. His home is in Mexico. He is from Mexico, though he's grown up in different parts of the world and continues to live in many different parts of the world. During the fall semesters, he lives in Princeton and teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. His best-known novel is called The Death of Artemio Cruz. His new volume of short stories is called Burnt Water. His publisher in America is Farrar Straus Giroux.